Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Joshua Hall, an associate professor of economics at West Virginia University and co-director of the Center for Free Enterprise. He was a previous guest on our podcast when he was an assistant professor at Beloit College, so it would appear that with those two data points, appearing on Research on Religion is the clear path to academic promotion. Professor Hall specializes in applied microeconomics with an emphasis on economic freedom, state and local public finance, and entrepreneurship. He was the past president of the Association of Private Enterprise Education, and to add some international bona fides to his vita, he is also a senior fellow at the Fraser Institute in Vancouver, Canada. In addition to writing a number of articles in his area of specialty, he has edited a book called Homer Economicus, The Simpsons and Economics, and recently published an article in the Forum for Social Economics entitled, Was Adam Smith Right About Religious Competition?, which will be the focus of our discussion today. However, if y'all out there are in listening land, are well-behaved, we might just talk about The Simpsons and economics for kicks and giggles later in the interview, so stay tuned for that. And tell other folks about our wonderful educational resource. We are on Facebook and Twitter. Please help us spread the word. Josh, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Tony, thanks for having me.
Hey, first off, some overdue congratulations on your position at West Virginia University, where I believe that's where you earned your doctorate, if I'm correct. So is that a little bit of a welcome back Cotter vibe there?
It is, and you know, I think Welcome Back Cotter ran for five seasons. I'm in my, you know, in my third year back, so hopefully I go at least as long as that. Actually, I'll probably go on longer than that since I'm tenured. But you're right that it's pretty rare that one gets the opportunity to return to one's alma mater, and let's just say there's a confluence of a number of different events, and I wasn't even anticipating even applying for the opening, knowing how rare it was, but I was encouraged by some of the current faculty, and I'm really glad I took it. I really enjoy being at a doctoral institution, an R1 institution, and a place that has graduate students in economics, and it's very different than my previous job at Beloit College, you mentioned earlier, and I have super fond memories. I plan on sending my kids to a liberal arts college, so I'm a big fan of that that model, at least in helping young men and women mature. You know, the opportunities professionally are so much better at a place like West Virginia University.
Yeah, West Virginia University, too, is an interesting place. It's a place that allows a young scholar to write a book on economics and The Simpsons, right?
Well, I don't want to say allow. It didn't penalize me. That's a good way to put it. I mean, we get no economics as a article discipline, and I received no credit in our annual evaluations for the book. But nobody's frowned upon it. I think it was largely finished before I got here to WVU, and so I don't think they minded me going out and promoting it. And actually, it can be helpful. You argue it brings attention. The school loves it. They've put it all over the school magazine and the college website, things like that. So it's one of those things. It's a little sweetener on top, but it's not going to be your bread and butter.
Yeah, well, it is a great book. It's a fun book to introduce people into economics. And my son loves it, who's a 16-year-old. So kudos on that book, and hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about it a little bit later in the podcast. It'll be a little bit different than the religious stuff that we're going to talk about. We want to talk about your article, Was Adam Smith Right About Religious Competition? And you co-authored that with Kathleen Sheehan, who is at Creighton University, and then a personal academic hero of mine, Pete Betke, over at George Mason University. So let's get down to brass tacks and ask, was Adam Smith right about religious competition?
Yes, he was.
All right, let's go on to the Simpsons book now.
Okay.
All right. No, we gotta. Oh, we can't do that. We gotta fill in the gaps a little bit here, right? We can't just say yes, he was. It is a nice, short, pithy article, and it does get to the point. But we want to do explore the religious angle of Adam Smith here a little bit. Let's talk about Adam Smith first of all. Most people wouldn't think about him when it comes to the subject of religion, since, you know, he's that invisible hand capitalism guy. So what's the deal with Smith and religion?
Yeah, I you know, it's interesting because I'm a latecomer to reading Smith, and I think if you had interviewed me a decade ago, I would have thought of him as the invisible hand guy. You mentioned Abby before, Association of Private Enterprise Education. Our logo is a visible, invisible hand, if, you know, you can imagine such a thing. So, and that's what's foremost in my mind. But I've been very fortunate to hear a lot of talks by philosophers like Jim Odison at Wake Forest University. And Jim really highlights Smith's first book and some of the overlap between his first book, Theory of Moral Sentiments, and The Wealth of Nations, which for a long time scholars used to think there was something called the Adam Smith problem, because you have Smith, this moral philosopher, he was that was his profession, econ didn't exist, and he writes this book on where do our sentiments towards one another come from, and why might our sentiments towards our fellow man or woman vary over time, or vary depending on who the person is, and where do good sentiments come from, and then how does this same person write this treatise on trying to understand why some countries are rich and others are poor? So it was hearing a talk by Jim that really got me to you know, reading The Theory of Moral Sentiments and getting a much richer understanding of who Adam Smith was. And it wasn't just about, you know, markets. He really was trying to understand patterns of human behavior, and in The Theory of Moral Sentiments, it's about our feeling towards our fellow man, and in The Wealth of Nations, it's about, well, how do we serve each other through this, indirectly through this marketplace.
Yeah, you mentioned Theory of Moral Sentiments, and we just finished off with a reading group at the University of Washington with a number of undergraduates dedicated to that book, and that's a tough book. It's a tough book to read because of the language of the 18th century that he used back then. But, you know, the concepts are rough for people who are, you know, straight line or mainline economists. It's just, it's a very different book. It does get into issues of religion at some point in time or another, and I would love to do a podcast at some point in time on Theory of Moral Sentiments, but Russ Roberts at Econ Talk, which is the inspiration for this podcast, actually has a extended series on the Theory of Moral Sentiments, and we'll point people back to that because it is an overlooked book that really should get more attention than it actually does.
I did the same thing. I mean, yeah. I was inspired by that Econ Talk podcast series to have a student reading group with the Theory of Moral Sentiments. And it was one of those rare occasions where you have a student in the reading group who suddenly you realize, okay, this kid is on another level, like well above me. It was a top student in philosophy and top student in economics, and I had to kind of be like, well, why don't you lead the discussion this time? You know, I'm just a I feel, you know, I'm a jeans and a boot scholar, you know, and I always feel like I'm catching up to things, and to see somebody like that who's just able to grasp these arguments and refer back to previous parts we read 3 weeks ago, it was great. And so anyway, he's off exploring both those interests in graduate school, so you know, that podcast, I think, really struck home with a lot of people.
Yeah, jeans and boot scholar you are, too. That resonates with me. So we have that there. We're blue-collar scholars, I guess. Talking about Smith, Smith is kind of an interesting character, right? He's arising in a time and place, the 18th century, as I mentioned. But he's in Scotland, where Presbyterian was the predominant faith, but also situated in Great Britain, where the Church of England had a great deal of sway. A lot of religious strife over the course of the 17th century. Is this going to be affecting Smith at all?
Yeah, I think that's for somebody who reads The Wealth of Nations, and you know, I'm a mixed bag of whether one should sit down and try to read The Wealth of Nations. I think you should start with certain books are better than others, but you can see how it's very observational. It's very contextual in terms of he's not only explaining what he observes around him, but there's often, for today's scholars, we would read this text and say, well, he should footnote that. You know, he should footnote that observation that when, you know, religious factions come together to disagree, that often spills over into politics. Well, what exactly are you talking? You know, all of what you just mentioned, his historical background situation is in the background, and it's hard for a modern reader, non-Smith scholar, to understand exactly, you know, what's the subtext of what he's talking about. And so I personally kind of take it on face value that, you know, he's true in his observations about religion, just like he is in just as he is true about his observations about the Pin Factory, mm-hmm. for example.
Yeah, it is a very rich historical book without much context at points and times. I happen to know a little bit about church history in England, so when reading his section on religion in there, I was like, okay, I understand this, but his history of money, oh boy, that one got me. But definitely.
Well, I think I used to work for the Joint Economic Committee, and we had multiple staff members. They were not economist staff; they were, you know, administrative staff who were working at the Joint Economic Committee while they were saving up money for divinity school. And there were several very religious members in the office, and that was kind of our lunchtime debates was over things. And I'll never forget the most animated discussion that ever had was one of the economists, who was a very devout man, but he said, look, I think every single book needs to go through an editor at different points in time, right? I don't care if it's The Wealth of Nations. I'm an economist, and I can say, we can trim out a lot of this fat here, Adam. We don't need this. There's some really great insights. And I don't think it's sacrilege to say that. And he actually held the same view of the Bible. And you should have seen this fight went on for a week and a half, and they just finally had to agree to disagree and not talk about religion over lunch anymore.
Wow.
But I think that you're right there that the sad thing, I think, is it is such an impressive book, and there's so many good things in it. There's very little, I think, if you're generous in the reading about Smith, that he got wrong. And you can say that, okay, either he's a very astute observer of the world around him, but ultimately he's fundamentally, since he's trying to get at why, you know, when you think about the theory of moral sentiments, people have regard for one another or have sympathy for one another. Since he's talking about those personal relationships, since he's finally attuned to that, that same insight is spread through across any situation that he's talking about, right? And it's only some where he hasn't had direct observation or hasn't really pressed on his own thinking that he sometimes might get things a little wrong, like he was a believer in the labor theory of value, so something is worth what the effort is put to produce, and if that's all you see, that might be the view of you might have because you haven't really thought about things that are anomalies, right? Like why diamonds are so expensive. We just happen to stumble upon some.
Yeah, those insights are in there. I would disagree with you a little bit. I don't think he was a full bore believer in the theory of or labor theory of value. He questions it, but he does kind of come down. That's what he. Seems to favor, although he doesn't seem fully satisfied with it, which is a neat thing about this book, that it wasn't edited, because you can see him wrestling with his thoughts rather than an editor, a copy editor, really kind of cleaning out the uncertainties or things like that. Although I have to admit, your friend over at the Economic Bureau, you're talking about editing the Bible. That's going to get me in a lot of hot water. I think, yeah, maybe if they got rid of the numbers, or at least a big chunk of the book of numbers. I was like, ooh, you know?
Yeah, that was basically his viewer. He's like, there's these things called appendices.
Yeah,
I remember that line specifically. We can put a lot of that stuff in appendices.
Yeah, not all that begatting stuff. You know, usually when I do my yearly Let's Read the Bible thing, I get the numbers like, boom, oh, okay, I'm done. That's usually around February or something. Yeah, but talking about editing Smith out, many people have done that. So we can provide condensed versions of Wealth of Nation to hand to undergraduate students or even high school students, if you're a fortunate one to in high school to read that there. And one of the books that gets cut out is Book 5, specifically Book 5, Article 3 in Wealth of Nations, where all the religious stuff goes on. I had an old version, edited version of Wealth of Nations. And when I first stumbled upon Smith's insights via Larry Iannacone, I went to there and I go, it's not in here. And he goes, no, you got to get the full volume. And it's in a chapter called Of the Expense of the Institutions for the Instructions of People of All Ages. Now, that's a pretty convoluted title. What's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is when you have to step back from that specific section and say, well, where is this in? It's in Book 5, where, you know, Smith, to me, seems to be laying out all of the things government should do or has done, and whether this is something that government should do well or can do well, or how might it do it better. So if we look at the first part of Book 5, you know, it's on national defense, not only explaining kind of from an economist standpoint why governments might have a monopoly in defense, but also how would we go about financing that defense. The second part of it's about courts and justice more generally. So it seems logical to follow, given that we're talking about laws and justice, and also how the sovereign might be constituted in some ways, politically, the organization of courts in relation to the sovereign, that then that's going to come up. Given his specific discussion about the spillover between religion and government, that next section I admit it's an odd title, The Expense of the Institutions for the Instruction of People of All Ages, is going to come into that part next, right? Because, again, he's trying to think about, well, okay, how should we, you know, as he famously talked about instruction, right? He was a fan of students paying professors directly because he thought if you paid the institution, professors would get lazy and not be, you know, not listen to their students and provide students what they wanted. And he has much the same line of argument here with related to religious monopoly.
Yeah, let's dig into that. But the insights on Book 5, for those of you who might be interested in a little bit more than the religious insights of Smith and are itching to dive into it, but Book 5 is really about what in economics they talk about as public goods, right? He lists, I think, four or five major public goods that the government should be providing. He's not the, you know, pure anarcho-capitalist that some make him out to be. And it's a really interesting discussion, as you said, on national defense and systems of justice and then education writ large. But also at the time, education was viewed as something that churches did, and education of people of all ages. Every Sunday we would gather and learn about what we should be doing in life. And that's, I think, what we do. So let's go ahead and dig into this. What are some of his religious insights in that chapter, Article 3 of Book 5?
I think he talks about, again, the issue of, you know, religious monopolies. There's a tendency to become lazy. You're not being, and we all know from economic theory, kind of monopolies can be bad. I always think of monopolies from the old Saturday Night Live skit. I'm going to date myself here, but I maybe many of your listeners will remember it, but the old Saturday Night Live skit with Gilda Radner, her name blanking, but it was on the phone company, and she would the tagline of it was, "We're the phone company. We don't care. We don't have to." And you know, that's what I think Smith's trying to get at is religious monopolies. They tend to get lazy. The phrase he uses, reposing themselves on their own benefices, and that, you know, we see new religions rise up if and when, you know, a monopoly church is not satisfying, you know, the needs of its flock. And, you know, and I think that he has a lot of, you know, historical examples to provide background for that as being true, and you know that competition, like competition in all markets, can be a good thing, and that it brings new ideas to the forefront, or at the very least, if to the extent that a uncompetitive religious market is moving away from the reason why it's somehow being captured. For example, for nefarious purposes, competition can be a good thing in that it can, introduce a way for people to kind of vote with their feet by moving towards somebody who's providing, in this case, more services at a lower cost, or better services, or more services attuned to whatever their religious preferences might be.
Yeah, I have to read this passage here from Smith because it's one of my favorite ones when I do my economics of religion class. This is one of the first places that I start, and it's one of the first places that Smith starts in his Article 3 there. He talks about lazy religious monopolies and how they're challenged by what he calls upstart sects or teachers of new religions. I got to read this passage here. He goes, "The teachers of new religions have always had a considerable advantage in attacking those ancient and established systems of which the clergy, reposing themselves upon their benefices, had neglected to keep up the fervor of the faith and devotion in the great body of the people, and having given themselves up to indolence, were becoming altogether incapable of making any vigorous exertion in defense even of their own establishment." And that, you know, in addition to the, you know, statements about the butcher, the baker, and the brewer bringing sustenance to people, and, you know, the one time he uses the term invisible hand, for me, that's the one passage that just really resonates in this book, given, you know, my interest in the economics of religion. But I mean, right in there, right? He talks about these clergy reposing themselves on their benefices, right? You could just see some big old fat clergy with a big old fat benefice. And my students ask me, what is that? And they go, well, you know, you think of it as a chair, you know, an endowed chair, maybe, perhaps. But it's really a system to support the clergy. And they're getting this from the government. And at the time, he's looking southward, right? He's looking down through the Anglican Church, the Church of England, and says, oh, the Archbishop of Canterbury, these other bishops are all kind of appointed for life, and they're fed and they're watered and they're given nice little estates. And, you know, once you got that, you don't have to try too hard. You just kind of repose yourselves there a little bit. And then, yeah, I mean, he uses the term indolence, and that's not a neutral word.
Right, that's sometimes where the historical gravity of the words don't really jump out on the page if you're doing like a reading a group with students. You know, you made me I really like that particular paragraph, and I particularly like it because it jumps to me where. One of my reasons for being interested in the economics of religion, besides just having opportunity to, you know, meet people like Larry Iacone and Jared Rubin, who I think are doing really interesting things, in Timur Kuran, how religion both can impede and speed up economic growth depending on the context. I'm really interested in the spillovers from religion, and a good, what I would consider to be good, normatively good spillovers. And one of the, so I mentioned Beloit College, and Beloit College is no longer affiliated with the church, but if you go back to its founding, it predates the state. It was constituted state in 1846, I think, and it was founded in 1843. I think I got my years right. The Congregationalist and Presbyterian Church had a meeting in Cleveland because they were concerned about their flock in potential flock in Wisconsin territory, and they couldn't convince any or very many Yale graduates to move out and serve as pastors at the churches in the territory. Surprise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't really want to move from Connecticut to
backwards
Wisconsin.
Yeah, actually, and Smith has a passage on that. I have to just pause you right here, because if I continue reading that passage that I just did, it says, "The clergy of an established and well-endowed religion," Yale University, "frequently become men of learning and elegance who possess all the virtues of gentlemen, or which can recommend themselves to the esteem of gentlemen, but they are apt gradually to lose the qualities, both good and bad, which gave them authority in the influence of the inferior ranks of people, and which had perhaps been the original causes of the success and establishment of their religion," right? So what he's talking about here is these folks at Yale that you're trying to convince to, hey, let's set up a church and evangelize Wisconsin. And they go, what's Wisconsin? Well, it's just not much there except lakes and mosquitoes. And people
right,
at Yale
right.
Say, oh,
and,
that.
You know, as are you know, a few fur traders
yeah.
and a few people trying to eke out a living as a farmer, as farmers, all without North Face.
Mm-hmm.
you know, I don't know why people thought it, other than the fur traders thought it was a good idea to move there. But there were folks there. I think that's great because there were folks there, and they wanted to establish churches. They had the means to establish churches, but they couldn't find enough pastors who were willing to move there, and so they said, well, let's grow our own. And that was why Beloit College was founded. That's why Lawrence, all these liberal arts colleges were started as a way, through because of religious competition, combined with, now what's interesting for me is they needed this because of the requirement the pastor be educated, go through divinity school. And I'm trying another paper, trying to further explore, what implication does this have for education today in states that were heavily Baptist, which had no requirement, versus states that were more Presbyterian, right? And just as a matter, it's because it's hard to separate out, is this religious competition playing out in terms of more institutions of higher education, or is it really just a population density story and the legacy of slavery? And that's very difficult, as you can imagine, to tease out. But it all kind of comes, again, people say everything's in Smith, and in some ways everything is, because it's such a big book, but he really was on, like, just observationally astute to being able to see what was going on or had gone on in certain circumstances.
And what still goes on, too. When I bring up this passage in class, my students always jump on me and they say, well, it sounds like the modern academy. Don't a lot of you faculty repose yourself on your benefices and become subject to indolence and we possess all the virtues of gentlemen, but we don't have the authority with the quote unquote inferior ranks. I don't like that term in Smith, but he's talking about common folks, and I'm like, yeah, when you kind of think about the folks at Yale, they don't want to have to, go out and teach their material to the general public. But it's a very wonderful passage that really makes me reflect upon my own current contemporary field and life.
Yeah. I mean, and there's just so much other great stuff on, and I mentioned this before, but when we have religious controversies, that often spills over into, violent political factions, right? And we're going to, and we want, you know, if we're on one side of this, the folks on one side of this religious debate want to use the power of the sovereign to enshrine their beliefs and keep out competition, because especially if you think that these other beliefs are fundamentally at odds with your religion. So, you know, I think that's observationally true. It's interesting. You were talking about the parallels between your students draw between our modern university. I had the same thought when rereading this passage with current debates over about free speech in the academy. That, you know, when ideas that the reason we need, just like we need religious liberty, because we want a robust a system where we're free to agree to disagree, but also free to change each other's minds about these things. We want free speech in the academy for the same reason. And yes, you can use speech codes to silence people, but you might be on the other end of those a few years down the road. So getting that message across that religious competition allows new upstarts to come in, but it also protects you should, you know, whoever your supporters be, should you not be able to curry political favor in the future.
Yeah, and that, to bring up religious liberty, this gets to you directly to your paper, and I want to kind of focus on your thesis now. When these little upstart sects start coming in and encroaching upon the benefices and the indolence of the established clergy, one of the things that the established church does is to try to stomp them out. They try to get the magistrate, as Smith calls them, to ban them or to prohibit them or to make it life more difficult to them. And Smith talks a great deal about that. But the other thing that he recognizes, and this is just a brilliant insight that your paper touches upon, is that this competition could lead to greater religious freedom. Explain that.
Yeah, the basic idea is that where we have lots of robust competition among, I always think of it as like, let me back up here. Where we have a lot of robust religious competition, where no one, let's say for historical reasons, no one religion can be quite dominant, we have to learn to live well with one another, and therefore we enshrine you know, some sort of barrier, some sort of law, some sort of restriction, either constitutionally or not, that provides for religious freedom. And we do so because we know if we're lots of small little factions, lots of small little sects, that's probably the best way each of us individually. You know, we might be on the other end of the short end of the stick at some other point in the future. And so that's basically the idea that motivated us in this paper, you know, is I came across this great data set from the Association of Religion Data Archives that tried to produce an index of government regulation of religion, and I thought about this passage from Smith and said, hey, I wonder if countries that have more greater what we would call religious fractionalization, but so more individuals in different religions are more likely to have less government regulation of religion. And you know, I think in the Republic of Science, right, what we're doing as scholars, we each have our part to play. And I like to think that I'm not a thick case study the text person, right? That's somebody else's comparative advantage. I enjoy doing that. I'm a consumer of those things. But I like to say, hey, I think this is a very interesting idea. There's very limited data out there. Let's do the best we can with that. And then let's let the thick people come in and say, hey, here's some problems, and let's work on those problems. Maybe we can get more data. Maybe we can supplement it with individual case studies or narratives. And I think that's the way our understanding advances, right? So I'm not one of these people, like I've had people say to me, well, I would never do that type of work because the data is so limited. You know, you really can't draw really robust conclusions. And I said, well, but how do we get people to want to do more work on unless we do something? And that's really what this paper came out of, was really trying to see, let's get a first look at, is there some relationship between areas that have greater, you know, greater religious competition? Are they less likely to have regulations on religion?
Yeah,
and on religious freedom.
Yeah, no, I love this because I'm one of those thick people that you talked about in my last book, The Political Origins of Religious Liberty. That's a shameless plug there. I kind of followed Smith's story, and that says when you have a lot of little factions, and you know, as you described, it becomes this balance of power. Well, if I don't grant somebody else liberty at some point in time, they might not grant me liberty. So let's just all get along. And you see this in the American colonies. I trace this a little bit in Latin America and the Baltic states as well. And what you do, and which I really like this paper, is that you put the numbers to this. I used to be a numbers guy, not so much a numbers guy anymore. And so you pick up the data set, you pick up your statistical tools, and you run some multivariate regressions here. So explain to us what you find. I guess the hypothesis here being that where there's lots of religious groups, or religious diversity, religious pluralism, there's going to be less regulation of religion because they're all basically coming to a live and let live position. So what did you do and what did you find?
Yeah, that's the idea. So basically, I'm going to lay out all kind of warts and all because I'm hoping the reason I do things is I want other people to follow up and improve upon what I've done. If I have a comparative advantage, it's doing doing early things that other people come in and improve. And so, and actually, I love people who create data, and I want to reward people who create data. So I and another hat I wear is I'm a co-author on the Economic Freedom of the World Index. And every year we just put this year's edition to bed over the weekend, and we go out and we take all sorts of data and we try to produce the best index we can that measures economic freedom for 157 countries around the world. And I love the fact that somebody went out and created an index of government regulation of religion. Right, basically religious freedom by country. And so what they did is, and I didn't know, I find it kind of odd that our program did this, but the Office of International Religious Freedom in the U.S. State Department has the task of promoting religious freedom. And so one of the ways they do that is they produce this annual report on religious freedom. And they've been producing it since 2001. So the John Templeton Foundation, who I'm sure has come up before in some previous podcasts, they basically funded some scholars to go through these reports for 3 years, because not every country shows up in every single year, I believe, and there's they want to look changes over time, or it doesn't test each country's report each year, doesn't necessarily touch on each element of how government may restrict religion. And they use that, they code different things in those reports, these verbal descriptions of what happened or the way government treats religion, and they produce two indices. And one's called the Government Regulation of Religion Index, and the other is the Government Favoritism of Religion Index. And it seems to me the government regulation of religion is really what you know, Smith's getting at. It's not a favoritism, although that can happen. But it's really about government not regulating religion, it's treating everybody equal, right? It's not favoriting, you know, one or imposing a burden on some and not on others, right? And so basically, they produce a number from 0 to 10, with low scores being less regulation and high scores being more regulation. And like Sweden is almost 0.27, and Pakistan is 8.79, to give you an idea just of the range of that data. And so then we just go out, we get a bunch of other explanatory variables. Our primary one is this religious fractionalization. Really, it's just, again, it's trying to get a measure of not only how many different religions are in each country, in a country, but how spread out amongst all of those religions the population is. So you could have 100 religions, but if 99 of them have one person and everybody else is in the one, then that's not going to be a lot of religious. It's still going to be more free than one religion and no other religions with anybody in them, but it's not going to be the same as if you had 100 religions and that population is evenly split across all religions. Uh-huh. So it takes into the account the size of each kind of religion in terms of membership. And basically, with a bunch of other controls, things you might think would be related to government regulation of religion, democracy, right? We might think autocracies might have different views towards religion than democracies. Are they a legal origin of Scandinavian legal origin or French legal origin, right? Because French legal origin countries tend to be more, things are more code in law, right, as opposed to British common law, for example, which tends to be more custom. And basically, we find across a whole lot of different regressions that the higher the religious fractionalization, so the more religions there are and the more they're equally spread across all those religions within a country, the less government regulation of religion there is.
Seems to prove the point. Yeah. And it gets back to what you said before. Yes, Smith was right.
I don't know if it proves the point. One concern we might have is, you know, ideally we would like to see this over time.
Right.
We would like to see, I want to know what was religious, ideally I'd like to know what was religious fractionalization 100 years ago. And how does that affect these things today? Or if religious fractionalization changes in the future, how does these government, right? And we just don't have that. Those data do not currently exist. Unfortunately, I don't think the Templeton Foundation funded further attempts to try to keep that index up. And I'm hoping that other people will do that and apply the same methodology, so maybe we can get at, is what's really going on here, this correlation, is it causal, or is it not a reverse causality where countries that are more open and have less regulation of religion have more religious have greater religious competition.
Yeah.
Because that could also be true, or it could be causality going both ways.
Yeah, that was the one thing I was going to bring up, the issue of endogeneity. I occasionally get to throw out some fancy words here, and endogeneity means that if A causes B, B might have some feedback on A, and so there tends to be a little bit of a cycle of causality. And I think that in large part, that is what is going on here, and that, you know, as I have argued before, that religious pluralism arising between the cracks of regulations, you know, governments cannot completely stomp out every single religious denomination. We've seen that throughout history. But, you know, once you get a pluralism of them, then government says, okay, fine, we're just everybody live and let live. And then as soon as you do that, it opens the door to less regulation of religion, which allows more religions to pop up and squirt out in all sorts of different places.
Yeah, I think I've done enough of these kind of cross-country studies where we're looking at whether it's like democracy and economic freedom or economic freedom and democracy, and that there's a limit to what you can, the story you can tell, I think, causally looking at these cross-country. What they can do, though, is if you have enough years, they can highlight for you interesting case studies for then people do the type of work that you've done for specific countries. And if I can maybe make an analogy, so in the economic freedom literature, you know, there's a lot, there's a tons of papers showing that economic freedom leads to economic growth. But growth might also lead to economic freedom. I love the work of Scott Bullier, who I believe now at North Dakota State University. He's written, I think, 6 papers on Botswana and really trying to get at why is Botswana different than every other sub-Saharan African country that has low levels of economic freedom and generally low levels of growth? Why did trying to understand the question of not what's the relationship between economic freedom and growth, but why did Botswana, why are they the outlier? Why did they have higher levels of economic freedom? You know, how did that translate into growth for them? What was the effect over 50 years? Was there backsliding in terms of economic freedom? Let's say growth fell for other reasons related to economic freedom, right, an oil shock or something. How did that affect people's views towards markets? I think there's a lot of really great work that could be done doing the same thing with religious competition and restrictions on religion. So yes, one thing we can do is say, okay, well, there's high degrees, so we have high degree of religious competition. We want very little regulation, But what happens when some crisis happens, right? And there's a tipping point, and one religion becomes a big player, and then has the power to try to influence the state to try to exclude competitors, right? What happens then? And anyway, so that was my main motivation in doing this, is really to see what hopefully might come from it.
Yeah, and it's a really nice piece. We're going to point people back to it on our website. It's from the Forum on Social Economics, and the article is called "Was Adam Smith Right About Religious Competition?" And your answer is yes, it was. And we got some good support from that throughout here. But I want to turn now to this other book. And again, this is completely orthogonal to research on religion, but it's a thing that I just absolutely love. Your book called Homer Economicus, The Simpsons and Economics. We're talking about how innovation in religion can be good. And it's really nice to see innovation in academics, especially economics, where people don't just do all the macro aggregate C plus I plus G, run some regressions to find out what the GDP is going to be like in the next year. You take a very interesting approach, saying, hey, I watch The Simpsons a lot. There's a ton of economic lessons here, so people should know about this. Tell us about the motivation of the book and what's in it.
Yeah. Well, you know, fundamentally, we're all teachers. Even if we're researchers, or largely view ourselves as researchers, none of us have zero teaching loads. And you know, I got into this because I was adjuncting. I had a master's degree, and I got an opportunity to adjunct at night, and I realized, you know, I wasn't very good. And part of the reason I wasn't good is I was teaching like every bad econ professor out there and doing a lot of graphs and what if this curve moves and this happens. And I read something by Deirdre McCloskey where she said, look, the real value of an economics class is not what you draw. It's the, I'm paraphrasing here, but the stories you tell about how one curve go, what happens when this curve shifts. Like, so, okay, hops prices go up. Okay, ethanol subsidies increase. So farmers plant more corn, right? What else? We want students to use their economic imagination to tease out all of the what will logically follow from that, or what might logically follow from that, right? So, well, what might follow from it? Well, what did happen was farmers put more corn in production to take advantage of the ethanol subsidies, but that meant something else got crowded out. What got crowded out? Hops. What happened to beer prices then? Well, some beer prices went up when beer producers couldn't substitute in production. So those types of stories, we use those all the time in class to, like, capture, to get students to use their, develop their economic imagination. And I was searching for things that resonated with students, or at least some students. It doesn't have to resonate with all the students. And for me, I was a big Simpsons fan, and I started using examples and bringing clips in, and it really seemed to hit home with some students. Now, you can't teach an entire class around that unless you pre-select for Simpsons fans, but I like to use enough examples that I'm hitting on different students all the time. And the book just came out of me talking to lots of faculty members who were also using The Simpsons. And I wanted to hear about how they used The Simpsons, and what better way than have them write something up. And it really was a joy to edit, because I got to see great things that I never could have imagined writing. And, you know, not only did I learn something, it gave me more examples for myself to use in the classroom.
No, it's an absolutely great book, and I use sections of it in my own class, too, because I tend to teach without all the graphs and formal models, which I learned but have long since been relegated to some dusty part of my brain. What were some of the favorite chapters, or some of the concepts and then some of the chapters that really resonated with you?
Oh, the one that a current colleague of mine, Andy Young, he wasn't then when I asked him to write this. He wrote the chapter on money, and he uses a quote from Bart's friend Milhouse saying, I can't go to juvie. They use guys like me for money in juvie. And he says, in what way can we say that Milhouse is money? Well, first we have to say, what purposes does money serve? It's a unit of account. It's a store of value. And then he proceeds to say, is Milhouse a unit of account? Does he store value? Is he easily divisible? No. And so through that, like, one quote basically walks through a really basic understanding of money, which is all students really need, and then a little bit of money supply and the overall economy using an example from an episode called Trouble with Trillions, where Mr. Burns has a trillion-dollar bill and try to say, well, what would happen if that trillion-dollar bill came back to the United States, right? And where does inflation come from? And everything it teases out of that. I mean, that's the great thing with The Simpsons. There's so many episodes. They've touched on just about everything that if you have economic imagination, you can see it there. And so really that's all I want people to get out of it, is to say, I don't necessarily think that reading, you know, I might not agree with this particular reading, but I can see where they thought that represented that, right? I was just reading an article today about somebody did an Economics of Star Trek book, and the review basically said it's wrong because it argues that Star Trek is a post-scarcity situation, because we can just, you know, teleport anywhere and we make our food in this thing that just produces it out of thin air. And the person said, the reviewer basically said, this person's a bad economist, because there's all other ways that, you know, things that are scarce. They're scarce in terms of who gets to go on this ship. And there's scarcity in terms of who marries who. And there's scarcity in time. They're not immortal. And so, you know, that's a fundamental insight, I think, that comes out of the book, at least I hope to students, and the way it's set up the way it is, with there's core microeconomics in the beginning, and then the back end's topical. Because I want to get students to see that it's not that economics is the end-all, be-all, but it provides a unique perspective on all these different areas of life that I think better informs the work that comes out of, you know, if you're a sociologist or an anthropologist, right? You're still going to be a better, I would argue, a better, just as an economist might be a better economist if they understood a little bit of sociology or had the skills of an anthropologist. I think you'd be a better sociologist or anthropologist if you understood a little bit of economics.
Yeah, and this book does this just marvelously. And, I mean, there's things in here from health economics to prohibition of alcohol and monopolies and externalities and all that kind of stuff. It's for those of you who are interested in economics, I really strongly advise you to pick this up. Or if you have some kids in high school, they would just eat this up, as my kid absolutely does. It's a fantastic book. And it also kind of resonates, too, with what we were talking about earlier and Adam Smith, that we have this kind of strange idea of economics nowadays that just kind of focuses on aggregate output and labor. And even though macroeconomics has really made a great deal of progress, the general public tends to think of economics in those aggregate terms. But Smith, you know, himself, you know, talking about pastors reposing themselves on their benefices because of the micro incentives, that those stories are there, and those stories need to be told, whether it be in the Anglican Church back in the 1700s or in the Simpsons episode on the monorail in the, you know, 20th century. So a great job in doing that. And I appreciate the type of economics that you do, and I hope that you continue to do that in the future. My guest today has been Joshua Hall. Josh, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.